From New York City,
the Comedy Cellar and Rethink Production present
Live from America Podcast.
We will make America great again.
How about new, you crazy Dutch bastard?
Live from America Podcast.
I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up, live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal.
No. Excuse me. Just so you understand.
We can't be the stupid country anymore.
Live from America Podcast.
I believe we can keep the promise of our founding. The idea that if you're willing to work hard, it doesn't matter who you are or where you come from or what you look like or where you love. It doesn't matter whether you're black or white or Hispanic or Asian or Native American or young or old or rich or poor, able, disabled, gay or straight. You can make it here in America if you're willing to try.
It's just words, folks. It's just words.
This is Live from America Podcast with Noam Dorman and Haddon Gabb.
Hello and welcome to the Comedy Cellar's Live from America podcast. And I'm here with comedian Modi. Hi.
Hello. How are you?
Comedian Lou Perez. Hi.
Hello.
And Rabbi Moshe.
And, hey.
And
Shalom.
Shalom. Noam Dorman, obviously. And our guest, Sarah Knight, she is New York Times bestselling author of the No Fucks Giving Guides, which she sold more than a million copies from all the guides together. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for
being here. A lot of Jews around also. Sitting
say
around.
The name of the book in English. What was it? I'm afraid.
So I forgot to tell you something. That Noam...
Just say it again.
No Fucks Given Guide.
No Fucks Given Guide.
Yeah, so there are four No Fucks Given Guides. They each have their own title. They each have their own curse words in the title, so we can go through them later.
Okay, this is a No Fucks Given Guide.
How many of them?
There are three in the world, and then there's one coming on December 31st.
Which one is the one coming up?
Calm the Fuck Down.
I am Calm Down. Which one is coming out?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Boo.
Oh,
who's on first?
You.
He's learning.
Sorry.
All right.
So what do you guys want to talk about first? You want to talk about the bombs that were sent, that you guys sent around today?
No, I'm so over politics. I can't.
Me
even.
Too.
Thank
I'm
you.
So over politics. Let's just
it's
move
the
on.
Worst.
Let's move on.
What are these books about? What are these books about?
I hope they catch the guy.
Here. Let's hear about these books.
I didn't mean to be sexist. I hope they catch the person. But I
bet
it's a guy.
Why it has to be a guy? Yeah.
Probably a white guy.
Probably a white guy.
See, this is what I like. If that was like a Muslim thing, you guys would be talking about it the whole time. But now it's like, I'm so over politics. Fine. Over politics. Whatever. All right, let's talk about
it. Well, you know, I like talking about politics when there's an issue. An event like this, there's no like for or against it or like we have to see, you know, it's terrible. Obviously, it's terrible.
It's very ugly.
But we learn it's bad, you know, mailing delivery system we have here.
Like it's like when 9/11 happened, we didn't have anything to talk about.
Yeah, we've been talking about it since ever.
Just because it's
not us, then we'll move on. So we'll move on. So Sarah,
don't be so sure it's not you yet. Anyway, you don't know yet, Carl. You just don't know. That's famous last words.
We'll be talking about it a lot if it's us. So that's how I know. So let's talk about your books and your guys. First of all, can you give us a brief,
synopsis?
Can I just talk about myself for like
a minute?
Yeah,
sure.
Yeah,
let's go.
So I was a New York City book editor for 16 years, and I quit that corporate job and career and decided to go off on my own. And I moved from New York to the Dominican Republic. Where I am flying back to tomorrow morning. So I wrote my first book, which was called The Life-Changing Magic of Not Giving a Fuck, and it became an international bestseller. And I pioneered what I call the Not Sorry Method.
Mm-hmm.
It has two steps: decide what you don't give a fuck about, and then stop giving a fuck about those things. And it seems to have kind of taken on a life of its own. So then I wrote more No Fucks Given guides. And
what made you go to the DR?
Well, my husband and I were looking for a tropical lifestyle. Wanted to get out of New York because it's fatiguing and expensive and busy and full of people.
Expensive for an international best-selling author?
Even so. I mean, my money goes a lot further in Dominican pesos these
days. I bet you it does.
And so we were looking
Mofongo is very inexpensive.
Indeed. Oh, Mofongo.
Mofongo's great.
relatively stable government, decent access
to
half,
from Haiti.
Half decent healthcare. We're on the furthest east side of Hispaniola. So there were a lot of reasons we wanted to be, you know, within spitting distance of our families if necessary, but we've been really happy in the DR except for the
tarantulas. What does your husband do?
He was a real estate broker in New York, and he's also a musician, and so our new life has enabled him to be more musician and less real
bachata?
Estate broker. No, but he is learning a lot of songs in Spanish. His Spanish is much better than mine, so...
You have children?
No. No.
Oh, you don't give a fuck about that.
I hate
You hate children?
Children?
It's a lot
you
easier to not give a fuck.
You hate children?
I do.
Oh, my God.
What really went wrong?
Morty hates children,
you never
too.
Saw my act, have you?
I don't think so. Is that a bad thing to say?
No, I'm not. I have a whole thing
What
about
went
children.
Wrong in your life that you hate children?
You know, my future... stepmother-in-law actually asked that question of my mother when they first met. She said, "You're a teacher, and your husband's a teacher, and what did you do that caused your daughter to hate other children so much?" I really don't like kids. You can't reason with them. You can't talk to them. They're annoying.
I'm talking about sons.
They're tiring. Very tiring. I have cats.
That was that bomb.
A little sexist joke. Yeah,
I get it.
I know.
I enjoyed that bomb.
Wow. So you can't reason. Yeah, but okay. We don't get bogged down in this, but of course you can't reason with them. They're children.
Yeah, I know.
But what you get out of children is not the joy of reasoning with them. It's the joy
certainly
of
certainly not.
It's the love and affection.
But the reason you can't
fulfilling your destiny and passing on your DNA.
Well, this is what people say. They're like, but you guys are so cute.
It's a mitzvah, Rabbi. Tell her
you'd have such cute children.
They don't
say
children forever, by the way.
That's not a reason. Yeah, eventually they're going to grow up into a world where they're all going to die. They're all going to have like explosive sun boils.
They don't say children forever, and your sons grow. To be able to be reasoned with.
I think we should talk about what happened.
But the question that I have is like, so your book series, are they basically like exactly. four people who have no desire to have children?
Oh, no. That's just a byproduct.
I'm just wondering how that
is. That's just a side gig.
I'm on your side, but I just want to tell you, like, I think the reasoning with the kids.
Modi, you have to find a nice girl. You got to find the right girl.
Settle down.
Let me get the right joke first. It's because the people don't hit their kids. And I don't mean abuse, but they don't keep the kids in line. There's a little smack up. It's not on the table. So all the time, these parents are negotiating with their kids.
Just shut up, Modi. That's the dumbest thing you've ever said.
No, it's not.
And then that's not an easy statement.
All right. What trigger you for not giving a fuck?
You know, honestly, I was having a really hard time, and I was having panic attacks, and I don't know if anybody had a panic attack. Do you know what that feels like?
Yes. Family members.
I thought I was having
one right now. He's sweating.
Yeah, he's
like
very
a beast.
Sweaty. He's schwitzing like a chaza. I thought I had been poisoned. Basically, like I was in my high-rise office building in Midtown Manhattan, and I was like, I'm dying. Poisoned me.
Yeah,
it's very successful.
So you work for a publishing company?
I did. Yeah.
Which one?
I was at Simon & Schuster for the last five years of my career, but with a few other places before then.
I don't want to interrupt your story, but I want to go back. I'm interested in what it means to be a book editor, but go ahead. Finish your story.
Oh, sure. So anyway, I was really melting down, and I kind of realized I got to get out of here. I got to get out of New York. I got to get out of corporate life. I have to be able to work for myself and not answer to anybody else. And that was the impetus for quitting my job, going freelance. And then I had this book idea, and it drew together all the things I was already feeling, and it happened to be a parody of a best-selling Japanese tidying guide called The Life-Changing Magic of Tidying Up. Mm-hmm. And I'm a former publishing professional, so I understand the value of a good parody. And then I wrote my book, and then it all kind of flowed from there.
A lot of times authors come with here with it, and they bring a copy. But
I was dying.
I brought nothing.
I'm kidding. I'm going to buy the book on Amazon.
Because, thank you. Or Barnes & Noble, or your local independent bookseller.
No, Amazon. And no, I'm kidding. We don't have a local independent bookseller anymore.
I think having a kid will solve all your
Strand, yeah. Strand, you think Strand sells it?
Do you think you're the first person who's told me that?
No.
What was told?
But I think it's true.
I don't have any problems.
So a lot of people...
We all got problems.
So, Rabbi, the Bible must teach us something about not giving a fuck.
Love that this guy's on as a rabbi. Yeah.
The Bible?
Yeah. Wait, he's not really a rabbi?
He's a rabbi. He's ordained. He's an ordained rabbi. You're an ordained lawyer.
I just don't
lawyer,
have any experience.
Aren't you? He's a rabbi. He has smicha. He has ordination from the most orthodox of orthodox. But he is not like a He's not a pulpit rabbi.
Why are you assuming he's going to fuck up before he...
I couldn't get the gig.
He has a congregation. You have no congregation.
No congregation. I used to.
What happened?
I used to have a congregation with my brother.
Well, okay, but anyway.
Went into business.
But in all seriousness, there's a lot of wisdom in Jewish teaching.
I went into charities, what you should have said. Yeah. Not business.
And quite often, I've noticed that when somebody says something, and I think she's really onto something about, you know, how to preserve mental health and certain things and deal with stress, really, and all these things. Quite often, it occurs to me there are actually things like in the Bible which actually speak to these kind of things that people don't even realize, but learned people sometimes I've heard talk about them. Does it make you think of anything?
In the Bible that talks about mental health?
Yeah, like are there lessons there? Like, for instance, the Sabbath. This is a big thing, actually.
Yeah, self-care Sunday.
To actually rest.
Yeah,
but, rest on the Sabbath.
Yeah, but when other cultures were not doing this, I presume that Jewish people, they understood that this is actually, you'll get more done in 6 days than you will working.
So
it's an insight into human nature, actually.
The Torah does definitely address, like, keeping kosher, you know, has health benefits. Keeping the Sabbath has, health benefits, mental benefits. But I think mental health is not something that you're going to cure with religion. I mean, real mental illness, depression, anxiety, all these things.
Poor mental health can cause religiosity, exactly. In my experience.
That's something that actually the Torah would tell you to go see a doctor. The Torah actually says
go read the Quran, because we do have
something to be said about us, especially now in these highly technologically advanced times, where we are still operating with the same brains that we've had for thousands and thousands of years,
millennia.
So being able to adjust to that, just like something like you talk about corporate life and all that, and all those hours working, and forget about, actually doing editing and living all that stuff.
Yeah.
That I'm sure there is, some insight to, previous, whether it be religious or whatnot, who could, help you chill.
Yeah. Well, I have this sort of mini theory that I've espoused, which is that As technology has advanced and as globalization has overcome us, we are expected to be connected to one another 24/7. You know, I'm getting emails from my publicist in New Zealand that I'm having to get back to her, in real time.
Mm-hmm.
And because we are the frog that is being boiled, and we have creepingly been forced to be available at all times, it's using up way more of our bandwidth. Right. Physically, mentally, emotionally than it ever was before, and we are exhausting ourselves. And so my books, all of them in some way, but particularly the first one, are really about setting boundaries just to protect your own, like, stockpile of mental, physical, and emotional health.
Did you ever read Cal Newport's Deep Work?
I did not.
But he talks about that specifically, and specifically for people who are professionals who are in a field where you are expected to, like, be on your email all the time, and how it can actually be detrimental to your work.
Yeah, I had a boss once who said, "I expect you all to be pathologically responsive." Eesh. And, this was a guy who I liked him a lot. I respect him a lot, but his life was work.
Yeah.
And it created a culture of our lives needing to be our work. And I did that for a really long time because I wanted to be successful. I was very ambitious. And I did push myself to the breaking point, but now I have stepped back from that ledge and said, there is nothing that is so important that I have to get back to you in 10 minutes.
Whoa. Actually, I think it's hundreds of thousands of years. Anyway,
yeah.
So I like that. I like the thing about the frog. I mean, no offense, Rabbi, 3,000 years. I like that. Actually, do you believe that the Earth is 100 human?
5,000 plus.
5,000, that's it. The fossils are 200,000 years old, for sure. Homo sapiens, I think.
You guys with the numbers are not very well good anyway.
Our belief is that the world was created in old world. So the world wasn't created as a seed. The world was created with the full tree and a full mountain.
Yeah.
So it was created, yes, it was created millions and millions of years old, but it was created 5K plus years ago.
I was an English major,
that's
so
what we believe.
I can't count that high.
Well, I guess technically that would be correct.
What? I don't know.
5,777.
That's when Adam and Eve.
That's when the world was created.
You're sticking to that story.
I'm sticking to it. Yeah.
And Adam and Eve had children with each other.
But that doesn't. The point is that it doesn't necessarily conflict with things scientifically or theoretic, you know, scientific theories of things being millions of old. It's not necessarily a conflict. The world was created complete. The world was created as if it was, you know, a full world. God didn't create. God created the heavens and the earth and all the animals fully born.
Yeah, but people, 5,000 years.
Yeah, Adam. Yeah. Adam was a. That's what the Torah says. I'm good with it.
Well, right. I mean, it's one thing to say this is what the Torah says, and all, but to say that the two don't, you know, butt heads with science and religion is a little that's disingenuous.
Well, he's a frog that doesn't jump.
It doesn't. It doesn't.
I love that frog that doesn't jump analogy. Tell us about it. Tell us what it means, Hatem.
Sometimes frogs.
I'm not even sure what it means. I think it means like you put a frog in water and you heat the water ever so slowly.
Frog. Yeah, that he doesn't know that it should.
And before he knows it's too late.
Escape.
Yeah, yeah,
exactly.
That's what, so it's something like you get a nerd to things. You get creeps up on something, and before you know it, you find yourself in a totally horrible situation, and you never. There was no clear line when it started.
I think we should get back to that Torah science debate.
Go ahead, go ahead, go ahead. I just wanted to explain.
No, I mean, if you want, I mean, 100,000 years is not the same as 5,000 years. It's just not.
In your opinion,
sure.
Wait. This is not like fake news. I mean, like 100,000 is not the same as 5,000.
Listen, in a world where Trump had the biggest crowd size ever for his inauguration, think of Trump's inauguration as the Torah version of years.
Believe me.
So, Sarah, how do you draw the line between not giving a fuck and, you know, being a bad person?
Oh, well, so
good question.
So thanks. my whole not sorry method is based in also not being an asshole. So yeah. The idea is, you know, you give a fuck, you care about something, and then you give your fucks, which I define as your time, energy, and money, your fuck bucks. You literally give them to that thing that you care about. So you don't give a fuck, you don't care, then you
which
don't,
it also could be work.
Then you don't give your fucks. That's a slightly different story because sometimes you have to give a fuck toward work because you have to pay your rent. So you have to. But the idea is honesty and politeness. So when you are declining something, when you are saying, no, I do not want to give that fuck. I do not want to come to your wedding. I do not want to come to your baby shower. I cannot make it to that meeting. I don't wish to, you know, go to your going away party after work. You respond with honesty and politeness, and it makes you not be an asshole while you also are not giving a fuck and not doing the things you don't want to do.
How did you get this woman to do our podcast?
Hilarious. Cold call.
That is the funniest thing ever.
I don't want to do your baby shower.
That was good. That was
remarkable.
That's pretty good. That's funny. Yeah.
Wow. So what made
I like talking about myself.
So there's a difference between not giving a fuck about, you know, going to a wedding and not invited to the wedding in the first place and say, you know, I don't give a fuck. I'm not going. I didn't want to go anyway.
So it could
be a defensive mechanism.
So I'm a big fan of Dr. Wayne Dyer. Do you know who that is?
I am familiar. Yeah.
Very. He also speaks very much about that. He doesn't call it fuck bucks or whatever you call it, but
it's
like
making a fuck
budget.
If
you do not want to go to that family reunion, you don't have to go, and you have to, and the opinions of people that you're worried about, and you just not care about those opinions. They're their opinions, not what makes you.
Yeah, the first step is not giving a fuck about what other people think, and that is I talk about it in speaking in the language of opinion instead of the language of feelings. Like, you don't have to hurt somebody's feelings by expressing your opinion and saying, I do not agree with you that baby showers are a thing that I want to spend my Sunday doing. That is wonderful that you want to do that, and I respect that. But I do not agree with you. That is an opinion I do not share. So it's just a matter of like kind of flipping your mindset a little bit, and it's really working out well for me.
Good for you. I also
I'm starting to care less and less.
As a comedian, and one that does, and. We just talked about this, Hatem, but I do comedy very much in places like not where comedy is not meant to be done, and for organizations and for charities and things that it's like, you know, and I see people.
It makes a lot of fuck bucks.
And I see people who go to these events and are just, they're tortured. But to be at these events, these are the fundraisers and charities and name their boss is being honored, so they have to be there.
Yeah, but you don't have to be there. That's really what.
So I'm telling you, I see this too. But like, you know, and just to get me out of the house for something that I don't want to do, it's just like, I usually say, if you want me out of the house, I need a check on a microphone, otherwise I'm not leaving the house.
Very good.
You know, and it's, and I just stop. And thank God, when you're a comedian, you can always say, I can't have a show that night. I can't, I'm traveling that, and you know.
Yeah, so, sorry, Mom, you're going for chemo, but I got a gig I got to get to. Sorry about that.
So
I mean, if she's a supportive Jewish mother, she would understand.
She would understand.
Is this one of the things which you talk about in your book? Because I've learned this. When somebody invites you to something like 6 months from now, 8 months from now, you say yes because it feels like it's never going to happen.
Yes.
And then when it happens, oh,
so what? True.
And,
yeah.
And I try to get out of the habit,
oh,
now. It doesn't matter if it's 8 months from now. I'm going to regret it. Say yep. No now.
So this is something I address specifically.
Oh, okay.
In the book. And so I say, you know, just do a quick visualization exercise. So you get that, whatever it is, call it a wedding invitation. I'm not trying to rag on weddings and baby showers, but they're easy for people to understand. You know, you get this invitation. It's in 6 or 9 months. And you're like, oh, I have to go. Yes. Visualize how you are going to feel when you are in airport security at 5 o'clock in the morning on your way to like Chicago in January to go to your aunt's second wedding.
Yeah.
You know, and just take a minute to think about how you're going to feel in the moment and use that feeling to write the RSVP card and be like, nope, sending a gift.
You're 100%. I agree with you 100%.
And send a bigger gift than you normally would, right?
Yeah.
So when someone books me for a gig in Chicago, and there I go, this is my price, but come on, it's the charity, it's the kids, and that's the first thing I go. But you know, and it's you're only doing 45 minutes. I go, no, I'm not doing. I'm doing airport security.
Your worth.
Right. I know exactly. It's torture. And I visualize the airport security. I visualize sitting in that hotel, waiting for them to pick me up for the event. It's just horrible. I just say
like,
no.
I have a very, very successful publishing program in Poland. I'm very big in Poland. Who knew? And my Polish publisher has invited me to come 3 years in a row, you know, to launch my books. But it's March in Warsaw. And I live in the Dominican Republic. And
you're married to a Jew.
I am married to a
Jew. Not a good place.
Who hails from Brest. So we should probably go. He's a Brest man. We should probably go visit.
Breast lover.
But not in March. And I don't, you know, they publish my books, so they know. I don't really do things that I don't want to do. And I don't want to travel to Europe for a 3-day tour of Poland in March. And I just say, thank you so much. You've been so supportive. I can't do that.
Plus, there's something really respectable
awesome.
About
you know you
someone
made it
who,
when
someone
you say start
said,
saying no. You know that's
exactly
well, that's the point.
Exactly.
But you yeah. but when you start saying no, you make it. It's really a.
It's so true.
Yeah, I started. I used to be a musician. I started saying no, and then that was it. So, and I haven't had a gig in five years.
Man.
So I don't know what you're talking about. Yeah, but doesn't work. You are right that when you're too solicitous, when people find you're too eager or whatever. They will value you less when you're like, no, like, oh, no. Please, come on.
I also just think that people are generally worried about saying no. They think that they're going to upset someone. And I look at it as I wouldn't want somebody to show up to a thing that I knew they didn't want to be there
That's
for.
That's because you've never been married.
I've
Do you ever like a big wedding?
I had like a medium sized wedding.
Yeah, well, so of course you want people to.
I just had a big.
But if people say if they can't come, I mean, three of my uncles didn't come to my wedding. My grandfather didn't come to my wedding. I had friends who RSVP'd and then couldn't come at the last minute.
That's not nice.
And it was fine.
No,
I was like, great. Like,
your grandfather, I'm sure, had a good excuse.
He's sort of infirm, but
yeah. So he didn't.
The
not
point
give a
being
fuck.
that I, well, I don't want to rag on my family, but. You know, my husband has a much larger family than I do, and it's a Jewish family, and there's bar mitzvahs and bat mitzvahs and weddings and anniversaries and birthday celebrations, and
it's enough.
We're invited to a lot of things, and I have learned that it's okay. Not every invitation that has ever been issued to you is an invitation to which you have to say yes.
Okay, but, and I'm sure you agree with me, you know, like, I have one really close friend I went to college with, and he had two sons. And I was a musician working till 4 a.m. and he lived in Boston and they had two brises and two bar mitzvahs. And I knew didn't matter. I had to stay up all night. I had to drive all the way to Boston. I had to be there. for those important events in my friend's life. Otherwise, I really wasn't the friend that I wanted to be.
See, I would counter that by saying, if you were in his position, would you want him to stay up all night and travel for 6 hours
yes.
to be at an event that you didn't think was important? Like, did you think the Bris was important, and did you want to be there? Because that's a different scenario. But I would argue that I don't want people to do things for me out of a sense of obligation, and I don't think I should have to do things out of a sense of obligation. However, there are certainly things that I haven't particularly wanted to do that I have, that when I have weighed the scales, I have said, okay, this is worth it in a lot of different ways, even if it's not ideal for me. But I'm saying there's probably 75% of obligations that you could actually cast off if you thought about it in terms of, I wouldn't expect somebody to do that for me, and it's okay to not do that for somebody else, especially when 135 other people are going to be at that Bris.
Yeah, well, it's not out of a sense of obligation that I wouldn't want somebody to come do something for me out of a sense of obligation. I would want them to come do something for me from affection, or, you know, some sense of warmth or whatever the word is. So, no, I wouldn't want them to show up with a sense of obligation, but there's not that many times in your life that you can really demonstrate to somebody that you care to a certain degree about them. And if you don't take those opportunities like the weddings and the Bris or whatever to do that, they will never be the same with you.
See, I think that those are culturally manufactured opportunities to display affection, just like Valentine's Day and Mother's Day.
They are.
And I think that you can show your love and respect and affection for the people in your life at any time in so many different ways that wind up being equally or more demonstrative and sincere than by showing up to a thing that is...
On a certain date.
And look, there are families for whom occasions of the sort that you've described are...
Wait until you hear how many siblings I have.
Indescribably important, and they would be just, you know, vexed beyond belief if you didn't want to come to one of them. But I'm saying, I think you can be a very good friend and a good family member and a sibling and a daughter and a spouse and a parent in so many other ways that you don't need to be constrained by... culturally created obligations.
Well, I just got married in August, and
sorry,
and
Mazel Tov.
Yeah, thank you. And for us, like I wrote the ceremony. We had our brother-in-law from England came in to be the officiant, mm-hmm. and it was a first because we're not.
Thank you for not inviting me, by the way.
Me.
Thank God you didn't hear about it. And for us, we're not religious. I'm an atheist. But it really was a real moment where everyone there was really sharing in the ceremony, mm-hmm. and it was a lot different than the other weddings that I had been to, and I was just so happy the people who were able to make it.
I was overcome with happiness about all the people that were at my wedding, but I didn't hold a moment's grudge against the people who couldn't be there.
What about in a relationship?
Well, I hold some grudges against people who I was friends with who didn't
name
even,
names.
Who didn't even say that they weren't going to come.
Oh, so well, that's
they left,
dick.
They, exactly. They left
honest,
us hanging.
Yeah. Honest and polite.
Yeah. No, I agree.
Timely responses.
How many siblings? Go ahead.
I'm going to ruin you. Whatever you're saying, I'm going to ruin your whole theory.
Good. Talk to a rabbi, for Christ's sake.
Well, let me give. I know. I want to give him material. Cody, I'm here for you. No. By the way, you know why I'm here?
How many siblings?
I'm his fan. I'm the fan. You know the YouTube clip that he brought? That's me.
I don't know.
I'm going to kill your whole argument.
I don't know if he was on YouTube. How many siblings?
I'm one of 14. Brothers and sisters, we're all married. We all have kids. From my perspective,
14.
I have a big family, right? So I got a Bris every other weekend, right?
Right.
Okay.
And
hopefully no do-overs.
And I think the point of showing up for people is showing up for them when they feel that it's important to them and putting yourself aside. You know, I know for me, like the most important thing in my life. And that makes me happy is that when my kid has a birthday party, when I have an event, when I have something that I'm proud about, right? If my whatever it is, I know my siblings, you know, they don't care. They got their own problems. They show up. I know, like, I, for example, I got a sister that's got a She's got a, her son's got a bar mitzvah in Australia.
You remember his name?
It's not.
Remember her name?
It's exactly. I got a multiple choice.
A Mendy, B Zalman.
I usually go through the alphabet and I land somewhere. But like for her, I don't want to schlep out to Australia. It's a 24-hour flight. But I know that there's few things in life that give you joy, and I know that there's nothing that gives her more joy than me coming to Australia. Now I'm not going, but the point is that I think that's actually there is something to say about doing something for other person is your feelings and your perspective is not is it's a, when you put that away and you put that aside for the other person, I think that's ultimate kindness.
Like, it's fantastic. Okay. And I would say that about, 4% of the time, just as I described, sometimes I go, you know what? I'm going to do this thing, even though I don't really want to do it because I know it's so important
to the
receiving, person. But generally speaking, I think we all have deluded ourselves into believing that we're so important to other people that they're just going to die if we don't go to their bar mitzvah in Australia.
But first of all,
and you might have this special relationship with your family, and I support that and I believe it, and I think that's great. But it's not the relationship that I have with my family.
There's another problem.
Hold on. Before you go, first of all, you're from 14 kids, but you all live in a ghetto. You all live in a Hasidic neighborhood. So when you say you're going to their wedding, bar mitzvah, you walk in on your way to getting a coffee. You walk in, hi, how are you? You eat a rugelach.
My brother lives
out.
In Canada. My sister lives in Australia. My sister lives in Ohio State.
Right,
my other sister lives in Florida.
There's nine more.
They're all over the world. Okay? I have one sibling in each 5 towns.
Next time you contradict me on the
All right, so here's another.
Marty's like, this now is my brother.
Maybe this is a bit too Talmudic here. I don't know. But you know when they say that, I'm not going to vote. It's just one vote. And what's the argument you always hear? If everybody thought that way, what would happen, right? So it's okay. You're just one person at somebody's wedding, and the wedding goes along fine. But at some point, if enough people are selfish like you, I'm kidding. If enough people don't give a shit, then all of a sudden that wedding no longer has a critical mass of people for the wedding to come off as you would like it to. So if everybody starts to think that way, then it will damage the event in a way that you never intended.
You could,
but you become part of that. People
but
don't
some
vote.
Some people enjoy going to weddings.
Yeah,
enjoy
exactly.
Going.
The thing
people
is, that's never going to happen.
Well, right. So that's the same way. So
there's going to be 80% of the people that you invited are going to really, they're going to have
but
time.
What if everyone reads your book?
You know what?
Isn't that the plan?
Because you do give a fuck. You give your fuck bucks. You spend your time, energy, and money on the things you care about.
I actually agree with you because I don't vote, and I always thought that argument was bullshit.
I spent 3 hours at the Board of Elections in Brooklyn today, so I am all fired up.
Why are you voting? what was the last contested election in New York that in your lifetime?
It is the only thing we can do right now.
But we know who's going to win every election in New York.
Well, what if everybody thought that way?
Aha!
That's true.
You see? She's a smart lady.
What about with your immediate, with your husband?
Does he get a vote?
Yeah. No, it's not about voting. About giving a fuck, support, something to support.
When he
not
wants
you.
A fuck.
Not you personally.
Easy.
I don't want to get into your personal life, but like somebody with their significant other.
See, actually, in this is special. One of the things that makes our relationship so great is that my husband has never asked me to do anything that he knew I didn't want to do. So if he had a family obligation,
well, he's smart, but in general,
that he even sort of wanted to do, but I didn't, it would be okay if I didn't want to go or I couldn't go or whatever. But generally speaking, I just think that we all have been conditioned to think we are the center of the universe and everybody is going to care what we do. And they're all going to be mad if we don't do something or don't want to do it. And what I say in my book and what I said in my TED Talk, which has 5 million views, is just try it.
You had a different hairstyle.
I did. It was different.
You did. You look very good.
If you just try saying no, you'll be surprised at the sheer volume of people who are like, okay.
Hey, do you really not care about Game of Thrones?
I don't. I just don't have any. I don't have any fuck bucks to spend on that. Yeah.
So I want to talk about something that's a little sensitive here. Mm. Religious Jewish people on airplanes.
This is it right here. This one especially.
Listen, I am very proud of my people. But when I am on an airplane and these religious Jews like just doing, behaving the worst way anybody could possibly, and don't try to tell me it's just random that this is not a stereotype come true. And I see people feeling anti-Semitic thoughts and I can't blame. I'm like, yes, I know. Like, how can they be so rude? Standing right over me, guy dropped a suitcase on my head. On the other didn't even say, so, I mean, like, what is with our people here? What culturally went wrong here?
I think this goes back to Modi, where people, you take them out. No, I think here's where Modi's right. Yeah. And I would stick up for my people in 99% of the things, besides for the plane thing. So I'm with you. They come out of their isolated communities, and where it's just them, and they have no peripheral vision. It's everything straight. I was just on a plane just now to Israel and El Al, okay? It was before Rosh Hashanah, so 99% of the plane was from Borough Park and Williamsburg. The plane's getting off, and 20 seconds up, Melcha! Whoa! the whole plane got up, and the back of your seatbelt didn't even go off. Now you can see that the stewardesses, they were conditioned.
They've seen it.
No, like, we're not gonna fight. We're not gonna fight. But then I got really bad. They were doing Ma'ariv.
I honestly don't know.
These are the afternoon prayer.
Afternoon prayer.
I don't know what the fuck is going on right now. Yeah. You just popped out of your seat like a hot potato.
We pray three times a day.
But the thing is, they could have prayed before they got on the plane.
No, but they want to make a balagan. They want to make a mess. They want to make a mess.
Yeah. Also, they're closer to God on the up. You know.
It says, so where should I start reading from?
Probably from the beginning. This fired on a plane.
Justice shall you pursue. Deuteronomy 16:20. Why does the verse repeat itself? Is there a just justice and an unjust justice? Indeed, there is. The Torah tells us to be just also in the pursuit of justice. Both the end and the means by which it is obtained must be just. Yes, it is important to daven with a minyan.
I lost you at Shalom. I don't know.
Yes, it is important to daven with a minyan, but it's also important not to inconvenience everyone else on the flight who might not care or appreciate your righteousness. Shabbat
so
Shalom.
It's not a Jewish thing. It's a cultural thing, and I think it's wrong.
It's a cultural thing. In their neighborhoods, people are like, you know, especially... I mean,
but they have to be aware.
The bumping into people, it's like, they don't say, excuse me, but it's like known that you just like, you know, excuse me.
It's
walk through. It's very rude cultural because, and then when they come out of the community, they don't know how to interact with, in a place. I mean, I don't want to be, I know you're looking like I'm crazy, Hatem, but I'm telling you, it's like you.
Do you trust flights if the pilot's not Jewish? Do you have to ask that question
before? Well, we don't have to worry about it because they all are.
It's not surgery.
I fly to Israel only on Delta and United.
Not a bris. I will tell you this, though.
I wouldn't trust a Jewish pilot.
But this is the thing. So I don't know if it's related to the fact, like, I don't understand the totally difference between Orthodox and Hasidic and all that stuff, and to what extent they really do have a contempt for non-Jewish people. I mean, I hear this stuff spoken about, and I don't really know, but I will say this. So we were all at the airport, and it was very, very delayed. I think it was going to Russia or something. And a Muslim woman came running up in a panic that she was a long line and asked the religious guys it was like 40 of them were about to go through the line.
Because they're all priority.
No. It was just everybody in line, and everybody was like, the nerves that when you've been waiting a long time. And she said, please, can I go through? And she had some reason that she wanted her little kid. I don't remember what it was. And I said, oh, God, like, please. And they said, oh, yeah, of course, go ahead.
Yeah,
they were nice, you know?
Of course, it's a Muslim woman running.
No. I thought to myself.
That's the end of that story.
I thought to myself, like, see, that was a human aspect that the detractors who just took the airplane ride with him and were so offended would have never seen coming. That it wasn't just a one-dimensional, these people are horrible. They were very sweet to a Muslim woman. So it's complex.
Yeah, but that shouldn't be surprising.
They were behaving on the plane,
I just think it's like you're putting a bunch of sardines into a tight space. I mean, they need space. No. You know, they need a magic thing.
Sardines are defined by being tightly packed.
You know what I'm saying.
I think what's
sardines
important
with very
also,
big hats.
Okay. I think what's important also is to see the way they behave.
You should introduce yourself. Because
my name is Israel.
Okay.
I'm here from Toronto. I flew in just for this.
Okay.
My name is actually Christopher, but all the Jews here, I'll say my name is Christ. So, where was I going with this? Oh, no, the thing is to see also how these people behave within their communities, and it's actually amazing, the things that they do for one another and to for anyone in the community, whether they know them or not. When you take these people out of their communities, of course you're going to get a reaction like that. Because by nature, these people are good people. They're not, I agree with Modi. They just don't know how to interact very often with people on the outside world. But they're kind people for the most part.
I have a question. It has nothing to do with like good or bad. Like, isn't why is it a good person that allow a person to do that? Isn't that just
Human
nature?
Wasn't surprised by that.
Isn't that human nature? I mean, you should.
A guy with a yarmulke.
No. First of all, no. I've seen people many times where someone asks, could you please make an allowance for me to go ahead of a line when people are like really tense because they're like, roll their eyes. You know, they'll agree to it, but you can just tell they're like, fuck this shit, whatever it is. And you would think that
then there's something wrong with these people.
No, and you would expect that. I just expected, or I was worried that these sheltered, cloistered, you know, religious Jewish people who were so rude or whatever, and of course, might have a view about Islam or whatever it is.
Yeah.
But they were so warm and gracious to her. It stuck out to me that this was not what people would have expected. Even I was like waiting to see what would happen.
I was
proud of them.
I'm still
that.
Not getting it.
You're not getting what?
I'm not getting what you're saying.
But because you can't see yourself from
no,
the world's
perspective. Because we're not rude people. We're, if anything,
yeah,
we're,
you know that,
we're the good example of actually, you know, historically and I think collectively we're actually a great example of goodness and kindness and giving back and being good to our neighbors.
That's
the Jewish people have been known for that for thousands of years. I just think again, it's like you're which world are you talking about?
No, I think we're saying the same thing.
Which world are you talking about?
But what?
No, I'm asking which world.
I know. Here's the difference. We Jewish people are always told in the Torah you're taught to help others and to be kind and to. It's like it doesn't matter Muslim woman or not Muslim woman, but it's the. What you're saying on the airplane when he gets up and goes, okay, I'm gonna get up now and here I am. It's not to be rude. It's just because that's culturally. He's just
but
like
they don't listen to the steward. It's shocking. I cannot believe people behave this way.
But you know what they're doing, right?
What
when they're getting up and they're standing in the back of the plane?
No, I'm not just talking about that.
One second. But you know what they're doing?
They're davening, right? Yeah. That's the least of it.
Well, what is davening?
They're praying.
I'm just saying,
a goat in the back of the toilet.
The total lack of interpersonal skill, you know, with strangers. It's just like,
That's what I'm saying.
No, when you want to convert, is that yours or the other?
Mine.
You gotta talk. You can't answer a question off the microphone. Jesus Christ, buddy! Even
come on, Jews, get it together.
See, this is what they do. You gotta talk
no,
in the
but
mic.
That's, no, but what does that have to do with anything? That has nothing to do with anything. He's saying I have a whole bit about how Jews don't encourage others to convert. We're not looking for people to join us. You know what I'm saying? But that has nothing to do with anything.
Yes, it does. The whole thing's about an airplane.
It's Jews on an airplane to each other. This is a great bit, guys.
Awesome. No, who's on first?
Doesn't matter.
Two Jews, three opinions. That's what you're seeing here.
The conversation will be intolerable if we hear both sides of it.
In 2 minutes, she's going to get up and go, I don't want to be
here. I don't give a fuck.
I don't give a fuck. This is too much of my fuck bucks. And she'll walk right out of here.
I haven't been listening for like the last 5 minutes.
So what other advice can you give us?
I think everything she said so far, I agree 100% with. I love it. Keep going.
She seems totally at peace. If you told me you were here as a transcendental meditation expert, I would believe it from the vibe I'm getting from you.
I have been called a Buddha of sorts.
Yeah, I see it. So what else? How can we get there?
Well, I did just finish writing this book called Calm the Fuck Down, so I think that's what you're picking up.
Give me more
I'm
going to
read all your books.
Very calm right now.
Are they on audio too?
They are on audio. I narrate them. So
I'm so excited. I have three drives coming up, and it's you.
Fantastic.
You and me are going to be in the car.
Fantastic. That's like you got like 16 hours of serenade.
Make sure you don't give
up. Let me ask you, what about not giving a fuck and religion, that relationship? What do you think about
it? I personally think that organized religion is the root of everything that is going to,
No, you can say it.
I'm reading the room.
I speak in the language of obligation. And I think that when you want to do something, it's great. And if you don't want to do something, you shouldn't have to do it. And a lot of us were indoctrinated or guided into a particular religious path as children. And if we decide that we don't want to continue down that path, still as children or as adolescents or adults, I think that's totally fine. Again, it's
and religion is all about guilt, right?
And I am not one to be moved by guilt, certainly anymore. I mean, I've honed my method over the last few years.
Can you write a book, How to Not Give a Fuck and Be Married to a Puerto Rican Woman? Because I'm telling you this, like, if my wife's upset about something and I'm not going to argue, I'm just saying, it drives her fucking crazy. Like, she wants a rise out
she
of me.
She wants a response.
I think that's on an individual level, and I charge $1,000 an hour for that, but
Do you do counseling?
Do you do counseling?
No, but I do now. just to take it back to the conversation you guys were having that was going nowhere, I do think that the whole cultural behavior is a thing, and I am frequently on planes full of Dominicans going back and forth from Santo Domingo to New York or Boston. And there is a similar set of behaviors as you were describing amongst
the
religious
in the back.
Jews. That, no, it's just like a lack of observation of personal space, not listening to the flight. Even when the flight attendants are speaking perfect
Spanish
and actually imperfect Dominican Spanish. We're not following directions.
A little jab
we
at
don't
Dominican
care.
Spanish, but go ahead.
We've never done this before. Numbers cease to have meaning. We're just going to sit in row 3, even though we're in row 16. And it's just a cultural thing. It doesn't have to do with religion. Mm-hmm. It's a cultural thing. And so, you know, in Rome,
it is not just a cult. Well, maybe that culture, it's not the fact that they believe in God, but different cultures have it. Like, I've flown to Korea. And you have never seen a more polite,
more spatially aware
such a
people.
Pleasure.
Yeah, no, it's just, it's cultural. And I would label it as being rude if I was going to hit my seat partner or peel my hard-boiled egg onto their leg or whatever. Like, I would say that's rude.
Spill my chicken fat.
But my mofongo is all over the place. But for them, that's just what they've always done. They've grown up. Peeling their hard-boiled eggs in each other's laps all their life, and so it's not weird. So I just think we all have to be kind of more, just get outside of our own cultural bubble, that's a terrible word, but and just be more kind of accepting and go with the flow about that sort of thing.
Can
Although the davening
question?
Does freak me the fuck out when they're doing it on the plane.
Would I ask you a personal question?
Sure.
How does your husband feel about not having kids, not wanting to have kids?
My husband and I have been together for 19 years. And so he's known since I was 20 years old that I didn't want to have kids.
Yeah, I'm sure you talked about it.
We did. We talked about it a few times. And actually one day after we had been together and living together for like 7 years or so before we got engaged, he kind of like said to me, he said, just because I'm good at math doesn't mean I need to be a mathematician. And I said, what the fuck are you talking about? And he said, I just realized that just because I think I'd be a good dad doesn't mean I have to be a dad. So I'm cool. Like, and now he was really like, thank God you didn't want to have kids. Jesus, kids, they're terrible. They're ruining everything. No, that's fine. I have lots of friends who have really nice kids, and I'm very happy for them. But no, he's totally fine with it.
Where did you go to college?
It's Harvard.
I was going to say, she's a smart lady. Harvard.
That's how I know her.
Where'd you go to college? Where'd you go to college? Is there any university?
You majored in English?
I did.
And you go to graduate school?
No.
No. And what part of the country? Where did you grow up?
Maine.
In Maine?
Oh, my God, really?
Yeah, it's wicked fucking far north.
Where in Maine?
Wells, Maine.
Well, I just came back from Wells. I summer in Wells.
Oh. so you make what, like $60,000 a year?
Yeah. No, I have this friend who the guy said I go to his kid's bris.
In Wells?
No, he has a summer. He's kind of quasi moving to retire in Wells, and he bought a house in Wells.
Oh, don't do that.
And we go there every summer to spend time with them. What's up?
I'm sorry.
It is such an awesome place.
It's lovely if you're only going there for like 3 weeks in the summer.
And I don't want to contrast it with Dominican culture nor Jewish culture. However, in Wells, Maine, there is a parking lot, and it's a big sign of the rates and everything, how much, you know, per hour. And there is no attendant. It's honor system.
So, okay, I was a parking lot attendant at a at a hotel on Ogunquit Beach in the summers, and it was $2 an hour. And people there, I had a guy try to run over my foot. I had people offer me $20 so they wouldn't have to spend $2 an hour at the town lot, because I worked for a hotel and they were trying to park for free in my hotel. I was like, guys, you have summer houses. You're driving a Mercedes. You brought your family of seven here for 3 weeks, and you don't want to pay $2 an hour to park in the town lot?
You said that to them?
Yeah.
Oh, what did they
I
say?
Had a boss who put the fear of God into me, so he was like, don't you dare let anybody park in this lot that isn't staying at this hotel.
Yeah.
You know, I'll come find you.
Oh, because parking gets very hard to find.
Well, it's aggressive. You have to plan.
But
the trolley. They have a lovely trolley system.
So they're not perfect, obviously. Yeah. But to imagine to have a parking lot, and it's more cost effective to have an honor system than it is to hire somebody for $10 an hour. Yep. Try that in Borough Park.
it's not going to happen. So you're going to continue with your guides, or are you going in a different direction for the next books after this one?
So number four, Calm the Fuck Down, is coming out December 31st. And then I have a fifth book under contract, which is a similar vein, another no fucks given guide.
Uh-huh.
And then after that, I have a book of personal essays that's also under contract, which will, I'm sure it'll still be profanity riddled, but it will not be self-help in scope.
How do the Japanese feel about the parody?
Japanese are into it. I have a great Japanese publisher. It's a very cute little package. Has a belly band. It's like all upside down. The first book has been published now in about 28 countries.
Wow.
And counting, and several of them have now re-upped for book two, Get Your Shit Together. Some of those countries are now on to book three, so it's been a nice little...
I gotta get these books.
Yeah. Well, what's it like, you know, selling it over a million? How does that change the next book? Is it sort of like when Michael Jackson made Thriller, it was like, could he ever get Thriller again?
Yeah. Oh, that's a great
analogy.
Wow,
what a cool... Wow.
Because I was a publishing professional for 15 or 16 years, I came at this in a very sort of jaded way, where I just thought, you know, I have personally shepherded a lot of books into the world as an editor that were fantastic and deserving and didn't do very well. So I was ready for my book to not, you know, to not perform, because that happens a lot. So as it did, and really the life-changing magic of Not Giving a Fuck has been kind of a slow burn and has really been selling steadily over the course of 3 years. And usually you kind of get 1 month, and then if it doesn't work, it's done. So it has really changed the trajectory of the other books. It was when we knew 6 or 7 months out that it was really doing well, that was when they said, okay, we want a sequel. I said, I want to write a sequel. And then we've sort of gone from there. So it has been affected by the market.
Have you been a guest on like The View or you know, one of these Sally Jesse, I don't know, one of these
Sally Jesse Raphael?
You're such a compelling guest, and this is exactly what so many people want to read about.
So the problem is you can't curse on most national television. So I was on the Canadian version of The View called The Social, which was awesome. But I was not allowed to curse. And I was on Good Morning America last year, but it was like a very sweet little kind of appearance. It didn't delve into the issues of the day.
But you don't have to curse to tell about the book. You can just use it.
You don't have to, but it's very, but producers don't have a lot of imagination, right? I've learned. So
that's terrible.
Yeah. No, it's,
you know, I have a question. Like earlier, we talked about, you know, you voting in Brooklyn and that. But the idea of like, you know, this is all we have. This is all you have. How do you think politics relate to the, you know, just stop giving a fuck? Sort of, because I feel like too many people care way too much about politics, where they're sort of hanging their whole identity on whether they're pro-Trump or anti-Trump. And as someone who's neither, it's really hard for me to see people just sort of devolving. Right?
So there's a lot of ways to come at that question. And I think in terms of, you know, the basics of not giving a fuck, do you care about it? If so, spend your time, energy, and money on it. Do you not care about it? Don't spend your time, energy, and money. The new book, Calm the Fuck Down, I actually write a lot about current events and how it is in some ways healthy to disassociate yourself from them. I call it ostriching, which is like when you just stick your head in the sand and kind of avoid it for a while because you otherwise...
Until people start fucking you in the ass, and then you're like, I gotta take my head off.
I... Well,
you go that way for
one of these days.
Rabbi him.
Really?
This isn't your Facebook page.
The rabbi over here.
Sorry, rabbi. Yeah. Our secret. No, we won't talk about that.
Not into the butt stuff, but I. I think that, so for me, my husband and
that
I
left. That was his next question, by the way, so you answered it.
My husband and I left the U.S. before the 2016 election, and then we have sort of been watching from afar what we perceive to be everything is devolving. I don't know who necessarily shares our views, but we're pretty concerned and sad and upset and rageful and despondent. And so I sometimes cannot look at Facebook or scroll through Twitter or watch what I leave the room when my husband watches MSNBC or CNN, because there's only so much I can take, but I don't want to become inured to it. I don't want to be the boiled frog. I want to remain informed enough that I am protecting myself with information and also, you know, do what I can to advance the legislation that I want to see happen. But in New York is probably not where that's going to happen. I moved heaven and earth to get our absentee ballots today, but probably the money I've given to MJ Hagar or Beto O'Rourke or Chris Murphy or Jackie Rosen is going further than my vote in New York. And I'm grateful that at this point we've gotten to a point in our technology and in my personal finances where I can afford to donate to races outside of
the United
States.
Interesting to me that you give a fuck enough about voting for something
amazing.
You know it's not a contested election.
So crazy.
But you won't come to your best friend's wedding.
That's not true. I never said I didn't go to my best friend's
exactly
wedding.
Where my,
I said
where my...
I said I didn't. I wouldn't go to my casual acquaintance who I'm not why I was invited.
You do follow me. You're going through a lot of trouble out of what is simply just a sense of obligation,
because
even though you know
it's not a sense of obligation. It's
but
something
it's
I
energy.
Care about.
She wants to put
you
energy
care about it,
in
but the vote doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. There's no contested election. You're right about your money.
But she can talk about it now. So.
It matters to me to be part of the collective voice saying this isn't okay. This has to change. And if I'm going to squander this one opportunity that I have, this one vote, I wouldn't be able to look myself in the eye the morning after Election Day. And I have not voted in midterms before. I have totally not voted in midterms before. But it is important enough to me now.
Do you know everybody that you voted for has been in office for like 25 years already? None of them. We don't even know who they're running against. We do not. Literally, nobody can tell me who anyone is running against in New York.
I think it's very important to exercise your right to vote.
All right.
Can I get you guys to vote for Larry Sharp for governor, the Libertarian candidate? Can I get...
No problem.
Thank you very much.
If they can come to my house and I can vote, I'll vote for him.
Well, can I tell you?
Is he going to bring weed?
Herbie Dickman.
This Sunday, we'll I'm doing Stand Up New York. We're doing a benefit show for Larry.
By the way, Cuomo really gets under my skin. Because the classlessness in a way of naming. First of all, the Tappan Zee Bridge is a great name. I mean, since I was a kid, Tappan Zee had a special zing to it. They changed it.
Not to Kashkushkong, you know?
The Mario Cuomo Bridge. Like, you shouldn't do that when he's your father.
Yeah.
It just doesn't look right. You know, Mario Cuomo was a nice governor, but he wasn't like LaGuardia Airport.
Which is a terrible place, by the way.
Right,
no,
but
it's becoming. They're fixing it up.
Yeah, sure. They are.
Well, LaGuardia was truly a historic mayor, you know?
Yeah.
Cuomo was.
And Jewish.
Was he?
Fiorello?
Now, so hold on. A few months ago, I received an honor from the mayor of the city of New York. And I got a tour of, it was during Jewish Heritage Week. They honored me for my comedic and acting, whatever. And then the guy gave us a tour, and he gave us this whole thing about LaGuardia. And he goes, whose mother was Jewish?
Oh, so it's matrilineal. Got it.
That's all that matters to us.
You could have just said
his mother is Jewish. You have to say the whole story.
No, he had to tell us about the event, about the award he got.
Remember the cab driver?
How was the food? Was the food good?
Remember the cab driver last episode?
No.
When he was talking about the cab driver in Israel talking
All right, well, listen, I think we've come to the end.
Last question.
Adam, this is one of your best.
She's great.
We went
ever
together.
So
she was great, and the other one that you also you fought with, and then gave it the one that organizes your office and your thoughts. And
there's a difference here.
Yeah,
no, she was a fraud.
No,
don't say name. Yeah, she was.
Oh, yeah, she kind of was.
Last question: Did you give a fuck about Me Too movement?
Oh, you waited until the last minute of the podcast to ask that question?
Hit the music.
I absolutely do. If you want to go to my Medium account, it's medium.com/MCSnugs. You can read my Me Too story.
MC Snugs?
Mm-hmm.
You have a Me Too story?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Welcome to read it. It's right out there for everybody to see.
Eve had a Me Too story. This is
seriously.
I never had a Me Too story. No one ever tried anything on me.
That's Eve? My wife has a Me Too story. It's crazy. It's crazy. What do you think about the whole movement? Do you have any observations about it?
About the what?
About the Me Too movement.
I mean, I think it's about time that more people are paying attention and listening to women saying, hey, this behavior has been going on since the beginning of time, and it's inappropriate, and it's not fair, and it's unjust, and it's violent, and it's scary. And, you know, I don't believe that there is anybody out there who's telling their story who doesn't deserve to be heard and who isn't telling the truth. And, you know, you can throw back in my face or anyone's face, you know, one story out of a million that has proven to be untrue. But for the most part, I think everybody is disturbed by and scared by and made uncomfortable by these stories. And it's easier to ostrich and put their heads in the sand and pretend like it's not true and it's not real and it's not happening, but it is, and it's happened to all of us. It's been happening to me since I was 15 years old.
But it's getting to a point where it's like just accusation. Now they become guilty if you
accuse somebody. No, it's
not. I don't think that the people who are making accusations are doing so for any other reason than that those accusations are true.
Well, there's this accusation now against
Louis C.K. We're talking about.
No, talking about Louis.
We should not talk about Louis C.K.
There's a Cory Booker accusation now, and
I haven't heard about that.
Yeah, and
that's unfortunate.
It's true that politics do play, and like Keith Ellison, some of the accusations don't get the belief that others do, and there's no way to account for that. But I do want to say, so what do you think about this? My and this does have something to do with Louis, that I had said to somebody about Louis that the diner owner in Iowa who was sexually harassing his waitress in some way to get shifts or whatever it is, he could not care less whether Louis C.K. gets to go on and talk to 95 people in the Comedy Cellar or not. And we were putting so much of our bandwidth into a kind of righteous rage about focusing on people who have done things wrong and people have been victimized, and not nearly enough time being spent to figure out how to stop this from happening going forward. Nobody is deterred.
The answer is displaying consequences. The way that you prevent this kind of behavior going forward is by showing potential future perpetrators that there are consequences.
Well, let me tell you why I think you're wrong. Let me tell you why I think you're wrong. Because one out of a million Me Too perpetrators is famous enough that it gets talked about in the news. And if you're almost anybody who's not famous, you do not worry about this kind of the consequences that Harvey Weinstein or Louis C.K. These are all famous people.
I actually think I would argue that just based on the personal conversations that I've had over the course of the last year, year and a half with friends of mine, Facebook friends, acquaintances, you know, people I know, who have come around particularly after the Aziz Ansari story, where I and many other women would say, look, what he did was awkward and gross and it was pushy, you know, but it didn't cross a line that a lot of other guys have crossed, you know, tenfold. However, that conversation surrounding what he did, the way he acted, that he didn't listen to know, that he acted entitled, all of these things.
He did not listen to know.
Yeah, that wasn't said.
That wasn't part of the thing.
Yeah, that wasn't part of it.
Sorry, that he didn't pick up her signals of discomfort.
Signals, yes. Yeah.
Sorry, stand corrected. The conversation that engendered with a lot of people that I was in conversation with on Facebook at the time caused a number of guys, and actually also some women, but mostly guys, to say, oh, like, so that behavior is wrong and not
I would be skeptical of those guys, being honest. But
well,
so
I'm not,
who doesn't know that's wrong? How could they not know
well,
that's wrong?
Well, you would think.
Yeah.
I would hope they would know. But they actually, to publicly on a Facebook wall, so in front of 1,000 of their nearest and dearest, yeah, to sort of say, oh, it was the notoriety that was brought about because Aziz is who he is that caused a discussion about behavior that is not behavior you would want any of your sons engaging in, that you would say you should know this is wrong, but maybe you don't know it's wrong because maybe you've grown up in a culture that hasn't explicitly told you this is wrong. This
so
is
I'm going to back her up on this one, okay? I don't think you know anything about religion. I think what you were referring to was dogma or, you know, organized what people. But I would challenge you to – I'm actually – that
You're
was what I was talking about
challenger.
Before.
Which
no,
one?
No. On the religion thing, I'm going to challenge you. But in this one, I'm going to back you up. So okay. I'm here with my a partner. We run a company called
Wow,
Charity.
Did you, wow, yeah. Did you not yeah. say that well?
Oh, yeah. So charity.com, charity with a D-C-H-R-I-D-Y.
You are gay?
No, I'm not.
Oh. I thought it was your partner.
No, no, with my partner in business, yeah. charity.com. And okay. we help nonprofits organizations raise funds through crowdfunding, fundraising. One of our clients is called JCW. It's Jewish Community Watch, okay? And they are an organization that was founded, you know, 5-6 years ago that to combat, you know, sexual abuse in the Jewish community. Now, there is sexual abuse in the Jewish community. Like there's
Rabbi
like
tried to molest me when I was a kid. Go ahead.
Lucky.
Is that true?
That's true, yeah.
Well, I'll give you their number.
No, I'm okay.
Down.
I don't remember it anyway, but I'm kidding. Go ahead. But no, it really happened. Go ahead. Go ahead.
Talk about that after the show.
Yeah.
I
wasn't molested. He tried. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. So there have been a lot of work. Obviously, people in the Jewish community care about this. And there's been a lot of work behind the scenes. And a lot of things have been pushed under the rug. And there hasn't been a lot of progress. But the moment that what this organization did is they created something called the Wall of Shame. Mm? And they started to publicize people in the Jewish community
yes.
that – that where that they did a ton of research. They weren't looking to just ruin people's lives just because of out of a whim or a guess. They did it. They would months and months and months of research, yeah. and they would back it up the story, and then they put the person
like
on
the Ronan Farrow.
Yeah. What's with the Jews
so,
and walls?
So let me tell you something about what has happened. So statistically has been proven that the greatest thing that you can do to stop this is to publicize the people who have been perpetrators. And it works on a celebrity level, and it has worked on a celebrity. It also works on a communal level, right? These people are now in the Jewish community, and everyone's part of some kind of a community, some kind of thing.
No, not everybody is.
Well, I would – listen, whether it's attorney
– you're living in one of the last ones.
Right. Well, no. So
there's
fraternity
in
college or if you're
a
religion and if you're a Jewish community.
He's still living like a real Scarlet Letter type. Way, you know, no. which I'm not putting it down. I'm saying
I disagree. If you live in the Hamptons and the YMCA, people know.
Okay, so
there's
so
always
a wall
there
of shame.
Pockets. People don't live in in foxholes.
Look,
and
if a wall of shame works for you, then
well,
then
it doesn't work for me. It has proven in the past 5 years.
Yeah.
It has proven to have stopped so many cases. Yeah. So many people have come through, and you see there is a huge resurgence. There's a huge sweep of change in the Jewish community because of this.
I'm very uncomfortable with the wall of shame type of thing because as an employer, I've had – Jesus Christ. I've had more than a few accusations that went up in smoke as not being true.
Well, that's why I prefaced
it's very troubling to say that. One of them was recently in front of a reporter. And it turned out not to be true. And like I found documentary evidence that it wasn't true. And I was able to give it to the reporter at the last minute and she killed the story. So that kind of thing is terrible. But I was just have thought that the thing like that I'm going to be focusing on my daughter is my wife said this and I said this on the show that she said, you know, we're going to have a conversation with our daughter the same way that black families have to have with their sons about how to handle the police. Like, A, to really teach, like, the woman in the Aziz Ansari story, she should have just left. Like, for whatever reason, she didn't just get up and leave. As soon as, like, she was upset he chose the wrong wine, you know what, I gotta go, this date's not for me. Like, she needs to be, like, inculcated with this self-assurance. Like, don't worry, do not give a fuck. This guy, as soon as you get a bad vibe, you're out of there. You're out of there. He's pressuring you to go to the hotel. No, I'm not going to. And then also with bosses and stuff, you got to be able to come forward. And it's hard and people are ashamed or whatever it is. But I think that we're not really laying the groundwork culturally with women to really, really equip them to learn how to handle these situations that are going to be thrown at them. And you know, and I.
But
I'm not
shouldn't we be doing teaching both. Teaching the men to not create the situations that the women then have to learn how to handle?
I'm with you.
Yes, but
well, that
but,
you just but, that's yes, in but, religion, you know, that you, but, you don't date yeah. and he's not listen, he's not yes, go to bed.
Of course, you should be teaching them. The question is,
there are things. That
are you going to stop murder by teaching people not to kill? No, you need to have the institutions and the police. You need to be able to catch murderers, and you. Yes, of course we should be raising our sons properly. I don't know that you're going to get much progress with that.
Well, to
be honest with you,
well, I think
so. You're saying that my vote won't count, so I shouldn't try.
No,
so,
but you know, I'm saying like if you go up in a house because I don't think you actually teach. We talked about this. I don't think you actually teach a son that. I don't think you sit him down and tell him anything that has any lasting impact on him. I think
in his community,
I think he learns that by growing up in a home where he sees that.
And growing up in a world where he sees yes. other men yeah. roam either consequence-free or be accountable.
Also,
to,
I think what's
definitely complicated things now, what's come out are the idea of gray areas, mm-hmm. too, and sort of how to navigate that.
Sure.
And one of the huge, you know, one of the big problems, especially on college campuses, you know, without a doubt, is alcohol.
Yeah.
You know, and equipping, you know, young women and young men to, I mean, if they're going to drink responsibly, you know, I mean, that's a little.
Yeah,
little
I mean.
No,
I
know. That's never going to happen.
No, I know it's tough, but Laura Kipnis wrote this book, Unwanted Advances. And part of it, she talks about a specific blog that these college women were talking about. And they were talking about being in these situations where they went along with having sex because it would have been awkward to say no,
mm-hmm.
or they didn't want to like make the guy that's feel right. bad, you know, and that's and when you start thinking about stuff like that, it's like, damn, man, that's really fucked up that these girls don't feel like, oh, I didn't want it to be awkward, so I went through with it. It's like that sucks.
Yeah,
and just to your point about the drinking and stuff, certainly I've made terrible decisions when I was intoxicated, but somebody else had a really hugely viral Twitter thread a few weeks ago where she said, you know, the time I went to that party when I was 19 years old and I drank so many SoCo and Lime shots that I almost blacked out and the guy walked me home and didn't rape me was not because I was sober enough to say no, but because he's not a rapist. And then the time that I was going out to my car, you know, after a work event and had had too much to drink and a guy came and called me a cab and put my keys in my bag and didn't rape me wasn't because I was sober enough to fend off the advances of a would-be attacker, but because that guy wasn't a rapist. So I don't think that it's...
Well, I think that's a great... that's a great
helpful.
Example. But what happened... But then you also have instances where both people are blackout drunk and they wake up together.
Right.
And that's where things get
I did just
want
to go to the original point and just say I think we have
great.
To stop,
no,
you know, blaming intoxication for a crime that is not motivated by intoxication.
Well, you're handling rape, you know, like with everything is thrown in. Yeah, like, I mean, you wonder about anybody's capable of rape. You wonder if there's not something very deep there that's not going to get changed.
Well, I just also want to circle back to a conversation we had earlier, because I think that this ties into your point, which is that I know from talking to my husband and other male friends of mine that realization that at some point in their lives, maybe many points in their lives, a girl has had sex with them who didn't maybe really want to, but was just didn't want it to be weird or like didn't want to hurt their feelings or it was just easier to say yes. And that realization has made those male friends of mine go, oh, God, that's terrible. That's the sense of obligation that I don't want people to do things for me because they feel obligated. That's kind of what I've been talking about this whole time, and that if we all understood that we are not beholden to this fantasy of obligation, we might all be living more, you know, autonomous and ultimately happier and healthier lives. So.
I'll ask you one more question. You would call yourself a feminist, right?
Mm-hmm.
Of course. And there's one thing about this that I always wonder. If a man Because I think there's something going on here which is undermining feminism in some way. I think that the any example you can give me of coercive behavior, whether it's even implied, like maybe you get not a good shift or whatever it is, then you have an unequal playing field, and doesn't matter whether it's a man or female, they're being forced to do something. But when you have a situation like with Aziz, and she doesn't explain, she never claims any kind of coercion. And I say, well, if a man had written exactly that same article that she wrote, and the man then complained about how she ordered red wine for me instead of white wine, and she ordered this food, and then I was on... Would anybody take that man seriously writing such an article, even if it was about some famous female movie star? They would not, because they'd say, dude, just leave. And that's because the very notion of that article is implying a kind of like, we're supposed to be protecting women. They're not quite the same. They don't quite have the same agency. And I think there's always a danger in any of these examples where the woman is not pointing to some coercion. And I'm not saying it needs to be physical by any means, but just something where there was a price to be paid by leaving. Then I think we're mixing apples and oranges, and the non-coercive situations, I think, undermine feminism if you think about it.
Well, feminism, the definition of feminism is the presumption of equality among the sexes. So I think with the Aziz Ansari story, that was more about coercion than anything else. And it was also, there's an underlying, the issue for her and for pretty much every woman in any situation is that you are the weaker party. But also there is that celebrity cachet that he wields, knowingly or not. And
that's not coercion.
And in her mind, she is at a disadvantage. And
if she said, I was scared, I was nervous about his physicality, so that would be okay. Now I get it. She was nervous physically. She doesn't have to take any chances.
But the attraction that she had to him was because of his celebrity. Because I don't know who the woman was. I think, as far as I know,
Grace
is still anonymous. But but I doubt very highly that she had ever slept with a guy who looked like Aziz who wasn't Aziz.
Nice thing to say. You don't know that.
Ooh. I don't know that. No. I was a celebrity then.
There's a lot to unpack there.
It's not nice, but I'm
at any rate, I'm looking forward to listening to your books.
So I don't know if you want to comment, because what I said is a little, not that controversial, but I want to make sure you have a full chance to answer. Then we got to go, I guess.
As a result of that case and just the conversations that I had with friends, I had a really interesting conversation with a friend of mine who's a psychotherapist. And she said, you know, there is just a huge amount of study around trauma. And what nobody can know, certainly since we don't know who Grace is, but what nobody can really know about another person just by looking at them or reading a quote of theirs in a magazine, is what they've already experienced in their life that caused them to think standing up and saying no and walking out the door wasn't an option.
Right.
I don't know this woman, and I have nothing against, you know, Aziz Ansari. He happens to be the example.
So let me ask you
a question.
So, you know, you deal with this in law school, like the eggshell plaintiff. So, is he responsible for something that he can't possibly know about her?
He is not. But
now he may have a low EQ. Like, people are born that way. Some people don't pick up on
signals. But it is our responsibility to give her the benefit of the doubt, also. And I think what the Me Too conversation is, the reason it is making so many people uncomfortable, including women, but largely men, is that we are forcing a conversation that people don't really want to. You saw what happened when you said you were almost molested by a rabbi and he was like, people don't want to be confronted by this stuff. They don't want to have to listen to it. You don't want me to tell you about the guy who just whipped his dick out in front of me when I was 14 years old. You know, in a parking lot in a Wells, Maine beach. This is why people are just at each other's throats about this stuff. They're withdrawing. They're lashing out. They're saying things that they might regret later, but they don't really know how to apologize for them. And I think that we owe a debt to people like Grace, but also people like Stormy Daniels and anybody who has come forward. Dr. Christine Blasey Ford, at great cost, emotional, mental, physical peril
to their own lives and their own well-being to force a conversation about this. And that's why I think the Me Too movement is valuable.
I was gonna say, because, you know, we don't know each other, and, you know, but despite what people might think about me because I chose to let Louis go back on stage, I'm actually not very to the right on this issue at all. I always have been very sympathetic to this issue and the way I ran my place and the way I've conducted my life. And, you know, so
you seem like a very reasonable person.
Well, I mean, like, you know, when like you hear guys saying, well, now I'm so worried about false accusations and men don't know how to act. And I said, nah, come on, that's a lot of bullshit. If you just behave like a mensch, chances are very unlikely that anybody's going to start coming out and accusing you. I think it's a lot of false nonsense.
Yeah, it's true.
I do think there are competing principles, what it means to have people essentially punished societally based on, you know, newspaper articles and things like this. And I feel very strongly that's a bad direction to go in. But I do feel also very strongly that we take these things too lightly, that the courts take them too lightly, the lawsuits take them too lightly. HR departments take them too lightly, and that's why I give a lot of thought to what can be done so that stops. Because, yeah, nobody should have to be traumatized or you know, people should be able to go to work and not be bothered with this stuff. I don't know that the Aziz, forget about the fact that we know Aziz, just any man has a day to, you know, it's if you could leave without any, you were never worried that you couldn't, then I think there is something wrong with going public and trying to ruin somebody for that. I think that what she tried to do to him, because he's famous, was way out of line for what she described she felt he deserved.
And I would just encourage you to think,
Did you read something in that story that you think that man should be ruined?
He's not ruined.
No, but that was her intention. He came close to being ruined. He didn't work for a while. He wasn't sure if people would do it. To this day, when he does a concert somewhere, it's not his performance is not the news. It's the fact that they let him perform.
Well, I haven't heard much about him since article came out.
And I'm saying she was trying to get even with him.
I don't think so. I think.
Why didn't she tell the story without mentioning his name?
I think it's worth.
Why couldn't she tell the story about what happened to her?
Also, I think it's worth considering it from the point of view that she really was very traumatized and disgusted and freaked out by the situation. Told a couple of people. It got around. I mean, it's not
but
like.
Why'd she have. You tell a story on Facebook, somebody she describes something.
You know that it was the editors of the website who really pushed her and urged her to tell the story after she had mentioned it to a couple of friends.
I'd like to take away from the circumstance over here for a second.
They could have written that story and talked about it. He's a famous person. We're not going to mention his name.
Yeah, but his name would have come out. It's the same way that everybody was talking about what Louis did for 15 years, and everybody knew it was him, and eventually somebody said his name.
Maybe it would have, but they could have tried. I feel very much in that story was the intention to get even
with him. The editors of the website.
They just wanted clicks, of course.
They did, of course, absolutely. And they may very well have betrayed their interviewee by treating that story the way they did.
Do you have some information about this, or are you just...
No, I just read it and followed it pretty closely.
I'd like to just add something over here. I think a lot of this is circumstantial, but I do think that there's... I think it's important to see what I believe is actually happening right now in with the Me Too movement and what actually a positive outcome that I think can come out after all of this. I think, you know, if you go back a few decades, the 50s, the 60s, and the 70s, and how the sanctity of relationships, the sanctity of sexuality everything just became casual. We shifted from a world where if you're going to have sex, you're probably going to have kids, you should probably get married, to all of a sudden now there's birth control. And I think that sort of erosion of the sanctity of, like, you know, being in the same room with a woman, there should be some spark there, you know, there should be something there. I think we've just completely, and I think that's men and women's fault, that we've really lost. And I think what's happening now is, I don't think it's about so much. I think what's happening now is we all are looking for coming back to some of that sanctification, coming back to some of that. You know, but sex actually means
something. I've heard religious people say this, and I understand where they're coming from. That part of this is the fact that we put such a low value on sex now. I don't know. I think women were probably treated bad even when.
But the whole thing, you swipe right, swipe left, and then it's
the good,
like,
old days were not such good
and
old
it's
days.
Like, I think, yeah, they weren't, but I think that
sexuality has become, it's become so desensitized, where we live in a world with, like, your 17 kids can get into this, to this thing. Like, what happened? I mean, he's a good kid. Right? Did I not teach them up with the whole culture? Yeah, it's like there's no
they
more.
They get conflicting signals. They have you have dating apps which are really designed to who do I want to have sex
with?
That's
what I'm talking
about. Yeah. And then at the same time you're supposed to.
And I think
we have to negotiate these things. We got to figure them out.
Yeah, but I think what's going to come out of this whole Me Too movement. And I think, like you said, like something more proactive happening in educating women and how. I think what people are coming back to saying, like, sex matters.
Listen,
you know what I mean? It's not even so much about, like, you wanted it, I didn't want it, but, like, was this even intentionally supposed to be meaningful in the first place?
You can't stamp out racism, and we wish that we could just teach people to not be racist. But when the law got behind it, that's when things began to change. That's what I'm saying. The law and the procedures, and that is where it really happens. That is not a cynical, trying to get men off the hook attitude. I'm saying that is where societal change comes from. Men having speeches with their sons. It's all very, very nice. It's not going to happen. I'm telling you, it's not going to happen. People need to, and it's not going to happen just because celebrities get caught. The guy in Iowa who owns that restaurant, you have to say, he's got to have some risk to him when he does this kind of thing. How are we putting him at risk? Because as far as he's concerned right now, he's still at no risk. And Louis C.K. going on stage or not going on stage for, you know, exposing, masturbating for women, he does not care about that. And we're treating it like, oh, now this is it. No, it's not. It's not. So that's my opinion about it. You are the best guest ever.
Thank you.
You're great. Oh,
and, I thought I lost you there at the end.
On the contrary, I like you even more there.
Do you guys want to share your information, Modi? You
ModiLive.com. And I'll be listening to your audios on my drives.
Thank you so much.
Sarah, where can people find you?
You can find me at nofucksgivenguides.com, and I'm also MC Snugs on Twitter and Instagram.
Okay.
Good night, everybody. Charity.com. Charity with the D. Hello. I came here for the plug. So
I'm sorry.
Here we go.
Charity with the D.
Charity with the D.com. Yes.
Okay. What are we putting money for?
What's that?
For his charity. What's
if you have
for
a nonprofit organization that's looking to raise millions of dollars, you should come to us.
Does that be Jewish? Lou on the Subway, it's my my charity on Twitter. Check me out there. And We the Internet TV on Facebook and YouTube.
Live from AmericaPodcast.com. Thank you very much. Have a good night. It was great.